being made a member of the Bardic Circle is that you have to wear a ridiculous white frock. You have to trail the ground and wear a dreadful thing on your head. And luckily, you're totally enveloped, so nobody recognises you. But if they do, they're sure to laugh. It was a great honour, though, because it is an entirely Welsh-speaking. The Eisteddfod, the National Eisteddfod, is an entirely Welsh-speaking festival. And as I'll explain when I read these poems, Welsh is not my first language. I have learned Welsh. My parents were both Welsh-speaking, but I'll explain as I go along. Now then, can you all hear me?
Yeah.
Is that right? Because I've got a pretty loud voice when necessary, because I come from a long line of Welsh Baptist ministers. therefore I can shout, and I can treat this as a pulpit. by the way, I thought those poems on the five words were quite remarkable, and I was incredibly impressed that so many men were writing poetry. In Britain, it's very hard to get men across the threshold of anything called poetry. Nearly all the people writing are women, which is very odd, really, since the men win all the big prizes. There's something wrong there. But I just think there's something what Ted Hughes said, that he could never admit he was a poet. You know, as a Yorkshireman, he could never admit he was a poet. In Wales, we can. I mean, in Wales, people say, what do you do? I say, I write poetry. Oh, you're a poet. I'm a poet, too, and they'll hand you their poems. It is definitely much stronger in Celtic countries than it is in Britain as a whole. But I'm going to start with a poem called Polar, because this set the book going. On the floor, the living room floor of our house when I was a child, was a, which I now realise was an appalling object, but I adored it. I was born in Cardiff, which is near the sea, but moved even closer to the sea, to a town called Barry on the coast, nearby. And outside our house, there was a park with a lake in it, and the sea was just visible on the edge of the park, very, very close indeed. So I spent my whole of childhood messing around in the park and by the sea. On the floor of the living room, we moved there when I was two, and I have a very powerful memory of it, was a polar bear skin rug. My father bought it in a junk shop and brought it home. I don't know what my mother thought of it, but I adored it and fed it with biscuits. And they put me down for my afternoon nap on it, and I loved it very much. But now, of course, I realise it was the most appalling object that you could have on the face of this earth, that you shoot a bear and make a rug out of it. Shoot a beautiful animal like a polar bear. And it's what we're doing, isn't it? What we're doing all over the place. It's a symbol for me of what's happening and what we must stop happening. I remember a very, very cold winter in my childhood, a legendary winter, like the ones we've had quite recently, especially 2010-11, which is when I really wrote this book. Polar. Sunlight and snowlight and sunlight. The lake glacial. Too bright to open my eyes in the dazzle and doze of a distant January afternoon. It's long ago and the house naps in the plush silence of a house asleep like absence. I'm dreaming on the white bear's shoulder, paddling the slow hours, my fingers in his fur. His eyes are glass, each hair a needle of light. He's pegged by his claws to the floor like a shirt on the line. He is a soul. He is what death is. He is transparency, a loosening flow on the sea. But I want him alive. I want him fierce. With belly and breath and growl and beating heart. I want him dangerous. I want to follow him over the snows between the immaculate earth and now, between the silence and the shot that rang over the ice at the top of the globe, when the map of the earth was something we knew by heart. And they had not shot the bear, had not loosed the ice, had not. had not. I was entranced by that cold winter. There was an awful lot of grumbling going on. Over here, I don't know, but certainly in Britain, they ran out of Britain salt and I didn't damn well care. And I haven't seen anything as beautiful since I was a small child. There have been some legendary winters. There had been, I mean, I think there was sort of 62 and 80 something. But on this occasion, because it was such an overwhelming snowy, the whole of Britain, from end to end, the whole of the islands of Britain, including, I think, Ireland, yes, were white. And on the, in England and Wales and Scotland, they ran out of grit and they ran out of salt. And therefore, although the main roads were cleared, the lanes were not. And we live 900 feet up in Ceredigion, it's the back of beyond, really. And we were entirely snowed in, and I absolutely loved it. We couldn't go to Christmas shopping, we had no presents, we had a tree, we had a goose, and we had a land of entrancement as far as the eye could see. We're 6 miles from the Irish Sea, and as I say, 900 feet, and on a clear day we can see Snowdon and some of the other great peaks of the north across the curve of Cardigan Bay, and every scrap of it was white, and I was in kind of paradise with it. I didn't care it was inconvenient, I didn't care about that. Where beech cast off her clothes, frost has got its knives out. This is the chemistry of ice, the stitchwork, the embroidery, the froth and the flummery. Light joins in. It has a point to make about halos and glories, spectra and reflection. It reflects on its own miracle, the first imagined day when the dark was blown and there was light. A distraction occurs to me, and that is the word flummery. There are 450-odd Welsh words in the English dictionary. One of them is flummery, which is actually brought into English by Shakespeare. The word is flummery, LLYMRU, and it means a whisking of beer or a whisking thin cream. And of course it makes it flummery, you know, all of the stuff, all of the bling that we now call it, that people used to wear. So that is a Welsh word. Anglicised in its spelling, of course. Now that winter, 9/10/11, began early, and at Llandaff Cathedral in Cardiff, I was commissioned to write a poem for a cancer charity, and it's a concert, and it was actually the end of November, and it was totally freezing, and we hardly got home. We live 100 miles from west of Cardiff. We hardly managed to get up the last hill. Very, 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 the winter was setting in already. And they had a choir of little primary school girls already to sing their hymns, their carols. But immediately behind them, they had put a very famous Welsh choir, the Treorchy Male Boys Choir, one of the best choirs in the world. Beautiful, beautiful voices. And as the children began to sing, and just behind them, the men came in with their low, lovely, enormous sound. You could see every single child who was being told not to turn around and not to move, sort of felt an astonishing magic. You could see that they were overwhelmed by this miracle behind them. So we got to the cathedral, and everybody was sliding down it. The cathedral's down a hill, down a path. Everybody was slipping and holding the wall and grabbing and shrieking. And eventually we all got into our places, and here we go. The Mabinogi, by the way, is the collection of Welsh legends, as like the Irish, four branches, yes? In Britain, we've got the Welsh Mabinogi. And I mention them here. First frost, no, oh, Advent, concert. First frost, November. World is steel. A ghost of goose down feathering the air. In the square, cars idle to their stalls as cattle remembering their place in the affair. Headlamps bloom and die. A hullabaloo dances on ice to the golden door. Inside, a choir of children sing, startled at a rising hum over their shoulders, like a wind off the sea. Boulders rolled in the swell, sweet and low. Triorchy male voice choirs, basso profundo, whelms them in its flow and undertow. And hearts hurt with the mystery, the strange repeated story of carol, candlelight and choir, of something wild out there, white bees of the Mabinogi at the window, night swirling with a swarm of early snow. I got marooned soon after that in Cardiff, because we have a flat in Cardiff, 12th floor over a river. Of course, we're very, very, as I say, close to the sea. I would imagine that what they call Cardiff Bay, and it's within half a mile of the sea, and yet the river froze. I have never seen a frozen river before. And it's totally magic, and I just could not stop using my iPhone and sending pictures home. 100 miles away, David, struggling to survive, you know, on the snowy hills, and now while I'm sending photographs and ecstatic calls about this amazing sight of the river, because a barge had gone up and cut it into bars it was a black and white frozen river, and the black bits were less frozen than the white bits, and it's astonishing. And after a while, I was there because in the winter I do something called Poetry Live. I travel and read to thousands and thousands and thousands with other poets, 6 of us, GCSE students. And I had to be there to catch trains because we live a long way from any train station in the West. So I was in the flat, and I'd catch a train to Newcastle or Liverpool or Hull, get back to the flat. And eventually I got the worrying thought that I wasn't actually going to get home for Christmas. Then it thawed a bit. Actually, it snowed and then stopped snowing. We thought, oh, it's over. Like it always is in Britain. 1 week of snow, then it all stops and turns to slush. Not that year, but we thought it was going to. So David got in the car and came to get me. That night, we got home, but that night, it snowed more than it had at all. It snowed like there were snow drifts in our lane, which were kind of like way, way high, because the snow had blown into great drifts. There was no way even a tractor could have pulled us out or pulled us in. So we got home just in time. We were thoroughly snowed in by this time. But I got this romantic feeling of how exciting it was. It was just life had stopped. All those grumblers were far away and I couldn't spend any money. It was great. Phoned all the grandchildren. I'm sorry, darling. Oh, Caviar, you can't have any presents this year. I can't go to the shop. Hooray! They knew that all they could send them was checks. In fact, I think I'm going to take the idea up. It's much easier than going shopping. Home for Christmas. A pause in the blizzard, and you fetch me home by motorway and marble corridor. The last hill from Blanglowan, slippery slow, the car crawls slipshod to the door. Tonight, we lie together listening as miles of silence deepen to the coast. Snow blinds the roof lights, roads forget themselves to north and east. I sleep, wake, sleep again, dreaming in stories. Turning, turning, landlocked in a myth, our white room drifted deep in moonwork of the silversmith. All night a breath from the east drives drifts from the fields through the avenue of beach to fill the lane with waves of a frozen sea so wild and still by morning nothing can pass. We rise, dress, light fires carry hay to 12 ewes waiting hungry at the gate. Birds gather in the garden for their feed of crumbs and crusts, healings, nuts and seed. Our wild tame neighbours, fellow inhabitants, I my scattering hands in hunger's silence. I set soup simmering, dough rising in a bowl, as in the old days, in our early glow, like being new here, in this house, this place, like being young and bold, bravely in love, like staying alive and brazening out the ice and snow, like being up for it, the shove to sharpen up, to take the great adventure of living the difficult day, the glamour. I don't know why, but it's going to happen any minute now when we put the tree up. We always have wrens in our house. Now, we can't imagine how they're getting in. My husband's an architect. The main part of the house is about 200 years old, and you know how the roof and the walls don't quite touch? So I think if that, they get in there, and the part of the house where the tree will be and where we spend most of our time these days, it's a great glass and oak kind of barn-shaped room where the tree is, and it's warm, and the walls do touch the roof, because architects now aren't allowed to not have roofs touching walls. And nevertheless, I get up, put the kettle on, and they're on top of the Christmas tree. I haven't put the tree up yet, but I can guarantee it'll happen. There's a wren sitting on top of the tree, just above the angel. To the angel's fury. And we put it out. Where the hell is that friend getting in? How? And then I wonder if there really are about 500 wrens and they get in one at a time. Or if it's just one. Hunting the wren. Darkness. Dawn a wound in the east. The garden's a ghost. I set the kettle purring, switch on the tree lights in the glass-walled room. Above the flight to Bethlehem, the angels and cherubim, the electric galaxies. On the tree's top mast, something alive, a dark star, a flutter of flight, of bird bewilderment. The wren, a wren, has dreamed of forest multiplied in glass, as tree dreamed bird into being. Its boughs and shadows spread on a forest floor of snow. I catch it in two hands, a cup of wren, release it to a frozen land. Morning, and it's back, a star of bird shit on the piano. Good luck, my mother used to say. Freeze, 1947. Long ago, in the first white world, school closed. The park disappeared, the lake froze. The town lost its way, sea struck dumb on the beach. Birds held their tongues. Land lay spellbound, world was an ice garden beyond fern-frozen glass. Trees held out white arms, waltzed with the wind and froze to stone. On doorsteps, bottled milk stood stunned. The polar bear rug on the living room floor rose from the dead, shook snow from its fur, and stood magnificent on all fours, transfigured, breathing flowers. And a girl on the road from school was stolen, her breath a frozen road, rose, her marble sleep death. They hit the paper. Babes in the wood, it said. I thought of her school desk, its name carved lid slammed on slurred air, her face blurred over books her eyes of ice would never read, her china inkwell emptied of its words, the groove of her pen like a shallow grave. Swans. Below the flat, below the balcony of the flat that we've got in Cardiff, which, although it's the city, although it's Cardiff Bay, in fact doesn't look down on any road at all. It looks down on the river. So we're at the back of the block. It looks down and up the river, and there's a great sort of bulge in the river, like a lake attached to it below the window. So it's surrounded by water. And for the 3 years, before this cold winter, a pair of swans had nested just on the shore, visible, easily visible. You see exactly what's going on all the time, and raised 7 cygnets each year. Now, swans, as you know, pair for life. And if one dies, the one that's left must see the body. Because if the one that lives does not see the body of the dead partner, it won't believe it's gone and can't get over it ever. When the snow melted, we noticed there was only one swan on the lake below the window. And this went on for days, and I rang up the swan rescue people, and they said, can't do anything, nothing. Unless he, if it's the male, saw her body, people just, there's nothing we can do to help him. And he's still there, actually. He remade the nest, everything. I wanted a very noble image for the dead swan. Of course, what happened, when the river froze, they can't live on a frozen river, so they were all the water birds were dispersed elsewhere. And I suppose they were separated by the depth of the cold, the intensity of the ice. Swans. She was brave in the bitter river, the Mary Rose, doomed. Ice chalice, lily in bloom. Thaw, her feathers and bones dissolve in the flow and she's gone. Flower that floated so light over death's undertow. In lengthening light he patrols alone, ferocious on his watery shore, where the nest from last year or the year before has browned to a dredge of sticks and sludge. In full sail, his body ablaze, bridge over unfenced water, he waits for her. The voice on the phone said, he doesn't know she's dead. There's nothing to be done. Our love rides the river like a king's ship, all wake and quiver. And I can't tell him. It's over. Who killed the swan? The last few lines are spoken by the swan. But, of course, everywhere a swan goes, because it lives on water, there is another swan beside it. Its own reflection is everywhere but the swan. Who killed the swan? She is mine, said the river, holding the swan on its palm like a lily. Said the sky, she is mine to have and to hold, my small white cloud of cold. She is mine, sighed the wind, wounding the air, winnowing water, lifting a wing. Mine, said the sun, noosing the swan with a cold gold ring. The cob swims in silence, its neck a question, head downcast over water's mirror. He lifts archangel wings to scorch the sky, churning water and wind to rise above the river, beating alone upstream. She is beside me, my soul, my dream, the current under my heart. Where I fly, she flies beneath me. I want to explain that, you know, when you're writing something, whatever you're obsessed with can kind of tow in other things and add meaning to something you've thought of for a very long time. And my mother was one of 10 children of a North Wales farmer and miller. 5 girls, 5 boys. And they lived a hard life. They weren't starving, but they certainly lived a hard life. And her father father was a tenant farmer. So the landlord man, who was Lord somebody's man, came and banged on the door, and he spoke English, and he sneered at me. And my mother just made a very simple decision, which, of course, I think many, many people per generation did, and nearly killed the Welsh language yet again. It's nearly died so many times. But the fact that suddenly there was a generation of people who not only were colonised, had been colonised, but felt colonised, felt inferior, felt sneered at, and they thought, I'm not going to speak Welsh anymore. And she decided she went to Manchester to become a nurse and just never spoke Welsh again. And therefore, when I arrived, and my father was a passionate Welsh language speaker, passionate Welsh nationalist, actually. And it was very difficult. There was much tension about this issue in the house. And to annoy my mother when I was a teenager, I learned Welsh. Now, I have to tell you, my mother was gorgeous. She was in every way gorgeous. And I believe that what happened to her is what has happened to black people, Asian people, anybody who's different. This is how people get treated. And if they get treated like that, then they get a bit cross about it. And my mother's crossness turned against her own people. Anyway, I started to learn Welsh, and she said, what for? Well, I did. Whenever I was on the radio while she was alive, she used to say, very nice, dear, not too Welsh. But she was gorgeous. She was very beautiful, and she was glamorous. And she met my father in North Wales at the National House Thetford when it was at a town near where her farm was. And, you know, she thought she'd died and gone to heaven when she was going to marry a BBC engineer and go to live in Cardiff. All I can say is it was my mother's tragedy in this life that she died before John Lewis opened the branch in Cardiff. Because she'd absolutely adore that store. She loved department stores. And when I was little, I was 6 years old, and I'd stand beside her and say, Mummy, we don't need one of those, we've got one. You know, and she was buying yet another bit of frivolity or a bit of cut glass or a bit of nonsense. And she was lovely, and she taught me all the nursery rhymes, taught me the name of every plant and flower, because she was a country girl, she knew these things. And although I don't think she ever actually went in the sea, we lived very near the sea, and she would sit on the beach with her friend wearing a glamorous swimsuit, and they'd gossip, go grown-up gossip and whisper, and say, go away, go and make a sandcastle. So I don't know what was going on in there, but sometimes I heard things. So I associate the thawing of the river, the thawing of that winter, everything suddenly loosening, with the loosening of that frozen language inside my mother. Thaw. Tonight, the river's on the move in a lovely backstroke, taking the tide with a kick of silk thighs, shoulders, heaving the flood through flux and fluency, stroking the keels of coot and mallard, a single swan, rocking a flock of gulls on its palm, coupling grebe, boats at their mooring on currents swollen with melt of mountain snows. And fluent. She used to go to, there was a place that had dances called Bindles near where we lived. And she and her friend Ina used to go to dances. God knows what I think my father was just on permanent duty in the BBC. But the two of them would go off to dances. Oh, I don't know who babysat, someone must have. Fluent. Maybe my father did. Maybe he just didn't want to go to the dance. Sleek as a girl in her silk, kissing goodnight before slipping out to the dance. She'd leave her scent on my pillow, the warmth of her skin on my cheek. Cold, pooled in the satin folds of her dress, her glint, the glint of her rings, her animal wrap of fur. And she's gone, night river, slipping its chains, fluent, reflective, pulling to sea under winter's weight, freighted with ruin and wrack, a burden of birds, words dead and alive, trees, driftwood, plastic, and all my lost mountain syllables sing on her frozen, loosening tongue, remembered, remembering. The mill was called Mount Mill, and I've been back there quite a lot lately. It's, the house is in ruins, but I can find it. I can find the threshold. I can find the door among sycamore and brambles and so on. The mill itself has unfortunately been turned into a heritage centre. I actually prefer ruins to heritage centres, especially when they're mine. Mount Mill. As if her broken words were scattered stones, each course of the house unmade like a thought unspoken. As if the walls ruined in rampant sycamore were a language lost to a mumble of elder and bramble, her story erased by too much silence. As if she stood beside me checking the place against the photograph, the field gate at the bend where the lane disappears, the cornerstone of the door, here where they stood, stilled on the threshold in a new century before the wars. As if the gap in the wall over the river still held the butter churn, its paddle turning where the current is slow with a secret dark, then out with a shining song across the ford where the horse's hooves once scattered water like sparks. As if she left home one day, no turning back and nothing to say, as if she might whisper again the words for water, horse, mill, stream, dŵr, ceffyl, melyn, nant, in the tongue the clywedog has always sung. I'm going to read a poem with a bit of Welsh in it now. It's Caroline Duffy has been one of the most generous ever laureates in Britain. She is quite remarkable, and I'm doing this while looking for this poem, which I did put a marker into it somewhere. And she has Guardian, in the Guardian newspaper, she has spreads of poems. So instead of taking all of the work herself, all of the glory herself, she has been generous to poets all over Britain and asked many, many, and further afield, so I'm of Ireland as well, several Irish poets have frequently been asked to contribute poems to her Guardian pages. Well, this one, about a year and a half back, two posh people got married in Britain. And the Daily Mail started saying, phoning up Caroline, are you going to celebrate? And she sent a chilly message by her agent saying, the poet laureate will acknowledge this public event through poetry. And her way of doing it was to ask quite a lot of people to write a poem, renewing our vows. She chose people she knew were in partnerships. So, gay couples, lesbian couples, married, unmarried, all sorts of different people were asked to renew their vows. And she simply said to me, Gillian, you have to put Welsh in yours. So I did. I've done it this way. It's called Er Gwech, Er Gwaith, which means for better or worse. And I have used a marriage vow, just the first line, as the first line of each verse. And the first one is the one which says, with this ring I will be wed. Next one, with my body I be worship. And the next one, with all my worldly goods I be endow. Right, worldly goods. I had a two-roomed ruin. Ceredigion, 900 feet up, near the Irish Sea, with no water, no electricity, holes in the roof, and I married an architect. Second marriage. Er gwaith. A rhod rwy hon i'r briodaf. Something about the ring in the blackbird's eye on an April evening. The raptor's jewelled stare. The marriage of sun and rain on dancing water. The circle of my arms round sheets off the line. Yours bringing armfuls of wood for the fire. Am corffydd a'n rhyddeddaf. Something of touch, taste, tongue, the language of hands, those chemical gifts one to the other. Grace and gesture, silence, reflection, that pair for life two swans on a river, soundlessly sculling the stream, lover to lover. Am holl olid badol, hyd gynisgeiddaf. My dowry, a derelict house on a hill, 5 fields, 2 acres of bluebells under oaks. Yours, a vision. You made sound the ruin, dream space and light, a room of oak and glass, letting the sky, the hills, and all of Ceredigion carry out in a glance. Ceredigion, where I live. Caveat, which means darling, love, have the consonants in the same sequence into words. That's a special device in Welsh language poetry. It's called Llanhennedd. Ceredigion, caveat, you know, the same sequence. I only dabble, but the fanatics. They win chairs and crowns in the establishment for being so fanatical about it. Okay. Yes. Another request from Carol Ann was for a poem for the Guardian, for a poem for a Guardian page, which was sort of June, July, 1 year, and all everything that was happening was going to be sport. So she said, I don't know if you can manage this one. It's sport. And I thought, I absolutely can't manage it. I had written 3 rugby poems, but that was it. That was never again was I going to be able to write a poem about sport. But I suddenly thought, my daughter is a marathon runner, among other things. So this poem is called Pheidippides' Daughter. Pheidippides, of course, was the soldier who left the Battle of Marathon and ran to the gates of Athens to say, we have won. And she's collecting, she is writing a book called 7 Marathons. And she wants the marathons in her book all to be connected with somebody in her family. So she's done Snowdon because we're Welsh, Dublin because her father's mother was from Dublin. She's done Santiago because her partner's from Chile. She's done Barbados because her great-grandfather on her father's side came from Barbados, etc. Florence because her son did art there. She's stuffed now though. She's got at least one to go.
Cork.
At least one to go, and I'm not paying for the fare to wherever she goes to. They're very expensive. It's easier to run a marathon in Britain than go to all these other places that she wants to go to. Pheidippides' Daughter for Catherine. Long silver girl who slipped easy and early from the womb's waters, whose child breath was a bird in a cage, the inhaler in her fist, her amulet. Grew tall, beautiful, caught her breath, outran the hound, the hare, the myth, the otter, salmon, swallow, hawk, the river, the road, the track. She texts again, this time, Santiago. She's counting 7 cities underfoot, running the bloodlines of language, lineage, for Ceridwen's drop of gold and ear of corn. To leave the battle of Marathon and run through pain and joy with news to the gates of a city. To arrive at the finishing line and say, Nenike Carmen, we have won. The hound and the hare, the otter, the salmon, the swallow, the hawk, refers to the legend of Cynadwyn in the Mabinogi, I don't think it matters that people don't quite know what that's about. They realise that some funny story's going on, I'm sure. A very tragic thing has happened in Wales, quite near to where I live. And you must have heard about it over here. A child was climbed into a car, and nobody knows where she's gone. Her name was April Jones. That town has just won an award from the Cooperative Bank. Very first time they've awarded it to a town where absolutely everybody without exception cooperated without a scrap of bitterness and with absolute desire to help everybody. The farmers searched the fields, climbers went down lead mines, people made sandwiches, and the only person who did something nasty had come from Birmingham, and he came to throw a bottle at the van in which the man who has been arrested was taken away. There wasn't a bit of that kind of shouting and yelling from the people, so I'm proud of them. I think they've done it, but the child has still not been found. I didn't know what to do. I think there are times when, if you are in the poet laureate as Caroline is, and she's written about Hillsborough, for example, the scandal of the police, you know, all those people were killed at the football match, and the scandal of the police cover-up. She's written about that, but that's in the past, you know, she's writing retrospectively. And I feel that the sorrow that people are feeling, the pain they're feeling about this child is really so powerful, and it just seems to be in everybody's mind still. I thought, I've got to write something. No, I mustn't write something, that's exploitative, don't do it. And suddenly, in 10 minutes, a poem came into my head. And and I kept it for a while, but they've got it now in the town, and they sent it to the vicar and said, do what you want with it. Daughter, a pearl, April. Born of water, born now in the river's arms, child of the mountain, mermaid of the estuary, everyone's daughter. Let her not be lost to the mothering sea, let her be light on the wave, let her change us forever, let her see her sweet face wherever we gaze on the river, the sea, like the moon on water. Let this pain that is sleepless lighten to love, to kindness. Let ours be the arms that caught her, love's weight, her light, the lightness of everyone's daughter. And to finish, Running Away to the Sea, 1955. Right. Carol Ann, again. She's a big friend of mine, and she's a friend of all poets, really. But she does give me tasks. And she was putting together a book called Jubilee Lines. You can guess what that was for, I expect. Right? And she asked 60 poets to write one poem, a personal poem, not a royal poem, not. Most poets are Republicans anyway. So just a poem about a year. And she didn't let us argue. She just said to me, 1955, no argument, just do it. Danny Apsey got 53, and Fleur Adcock got 54. I got 55. Actually, it turned out to be just the right thing for me. I've never written about this in my life. And it's sort of a part of my growing up which was fizzing in a way and probably fired me with much of the energy I ended up with. It was my last year as a schoolgirl. Now, what you have to understand is there was no such thing as a teenager then. The word not being invented. It was a non-permitted word. We were schoolgirls with work to do, and life would happen one day if we worked hard enough to deserve it, and we had to get down to it, and we had to get our A-levels and get to university, etc. And all I could think of, because, you know, I think we were all very young for our age as well, I think probably, and there's teenagers now far more sophisticated. We weren't sophisticated at all. We were just sort of fizzing with energy, longing, disappointment, rage. And out there, on the other side of a very high wall, was life. And boys. And love. And by the time I got out, they'd all be gone. And what made it much worse was, I was in a convent boarding school. Right, so one day, a friend and I just bunked off and ran and ran and ran and ran. You know, you run because you're sort of raging. How am I ever going to get out of this place and begin to live? Running away to the sea. It might have been heat stroke, the unfocused flame of desire for a name in a book, a face on the screen, the anonymous object of love. Two schoolgirls running like wildfire, bunking off through dunes to the sea, breathless. We were lost and free east of Eden. It was James Dean, Elvis, Bill Haley and the Comets. It was Heartbreak Hotel on the gramophone. It was Heathcliff by torchlight in bed off the lights out. The dunes were molten glass. We slowed to a dawdle, rippling sound with our toes, grains of gold through our fingers, on our skin, in our hair, without words to say why or who or where. This I remember. The hour was still, bees browsing sea lavender, and beyond the dunes the channel as blue as the Gulf of Araby, a name from the drowse of a daydreaming lesson. Some on the board, the chalk, sister's hand, a faraway voice as if heard through water, murmuring rosaries, Egypt, the Red Sea, the bitter lakes, Suez, a psalm of biblical names called geography. That was the last day the world stood still. In a year, there'd be tanks in Budapest, over Sinai, bombers on the move, and I'd be in the streets in the march against war as empires loosened their grip. It was almost like love.